Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's March 11th. Currently, we've got 30 degrees here in Old Town Park City, 33 degrees in the Heber Valley, and on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie, and I hope everyone is enjoying somewhat of a cool start out there this morning. We've got some high clouds that are building in from the west and southwest. It's not going to be completely cloudy today, but we'll call it partly cloudy skies as you get over towards Park City and the Heber Valley. But temperatures are still going to warm up despite the cloud cover, so we're looking at highs warming back to around the 50 degree mark there in Park City. And for the Heber Valley, we're looking at highs back into the mid 50s as we go throughout today. Now tonight, we'll get rid of most of those clouds across the area, so we'll call it mostly clear skies as we drop back down into the upper 20s in the Heber Valley, right around 30 degrees for our friends in Park City. And then as we go throughout the day on your Wednesday, we're looking at, we'll call it partly cloudy skies, but we'll start to see a few more clouds on the increase. We'll also notice those winds starting to pick up. They'll become gusty out of the south and west, anywhere between 20 to 30 miles per hour across the area. And those gusty winds will be with us throughout the day, but they'll still help to keep those temperatures fairly warm during your Wednesday afternoon, with highs in the upper 40s around Park City and highs in the low to mid 50s there in the Heber Valley. Then we got to start talking about a change. You know, we're going to go from spring back to wintertime in a big way as we get towards the end of the work week. As we go into your Wednesday night, those clouds will increase again across the area. And as those clouds increase, it'll help to hold our temperatures up to right around the low to mid 30s for overnight lows. And then as we go into your Thursday, we'll start off with some rain and snow mixed across the Heber Valley, with temperatures climbing into the upper 40s. But in Park City, likely starting to see that precipitation moving in as all snow. And yeah, it's going to be another snowy Thursday afternoon and the Thursday night across the Park City area, where we could be talking about several inches of snow coming down with that system as it moves on through. The Heber Valley will likely see rain changing over to snow by Thursday evening. And that could affect probably the time that people start to get off from work and head home on Thursday afternoon into the evening hours. So be aware of that. Could have some issues, a slushy Thursday evening commute. And then we'll see that snow continuing Thursday night for all of the area there, with temperatures dropping back down into the low to mid 20s. So yes, all that snow that will be falling will be accumulating Thursday night into Friday morning. And then for your Friday, yeah, we're back to winter. We're talking highs struggling to get above freezing again for both Park City and the Heber Valley. And we'll have some off and on snow showers slowly tapering off as we go into the afternoon hours. But we're not done with winter, because as we get into the weekend, Saturday, we've got another quick moving system that's going to bring snow, accumulating snow, both to the Heber Valley and Park City. So if you wanted to see some more snow, we've got more of that coming your way on Saturday. And we may get a little bit of a break as we go into Sunday with some frigid temperatures as we drop back down into the teens. But Leslie, we've got more rain and snow on the way for the beginning of next week. So it's an active pattern.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with a look in the backcountry, on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, we have Nikki. Good morning.
Good morning. So today's pretty similar to yesterday. It was generally quiet in the backcountry. We've seen natural and skier-triggered wet loose avalanches on those south-facing slopes and those west-facing slopes. Also in the backcountry yesterday, we did get a report of a large wind slab that was remotely triggered in a cross-loaded area. So wind slab should be on the radar today. We're going to want to think about three main things. The first, like I just mentioned, that wind drifted snow. So winds picked up overnight and yesterday. They could have created some isolated softer hard slabs at the upper elevations, and those slabs of wind drifted snow are sitting on top of those small grain facets. So they're likely to break deeper and larger than expected. So watch for and avoid any steep wind drifted slopes. Then we're still talking about those facets. So we've got that upper layer facets that formed beneath last week's storm. It's marked by a dirt layer that's higher in the snowpack. And then we've got those deep facets lower in the snowpack that have been around since the holidays. These are now 2 to 4 feet deep and likely to be triggered in a shallow slope or somewhere that has already avalanched this season. Recent field work is showing that these facets are trending in the right direction, but they still warrant caution. And then finally, just the wet snow. So we've got another day of warm temperatures. Some areas didn't drop below freezing overnight, so look for wet snow on those solar aspects as the temps heat up throughout the day.
Nikki, thanks so much. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Deputy Summit County Manager Jana Young and Housing and Economic Development Director Jeff Jones, talking about the agendas for two county council meetings this week. Also, we'll have the 2025 Utah Legislative Postmortem Report with KUER reporter Sage Miller. Finally, People's Health Clinic Director of Operations Dahlia Gonzalez discusses the creation of a patient advisory committee. The Summit County Council meets twice this week. In the studio with a preview of the meeting, I have Deputy County Manager Janelle Young on the phone with us. I've got Housing and Economic Development Director Jeff Jones. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Jeff, good morning, Leslie.
Hey, Jeff, there you are. Hey, first off, let's just start with you, Jeff. We've got a work session on Wednesday starting at 10 a.m. at the Richens Auditorium to discuss housing. So what about housing?
Well, I think this is a continuation of the topic of housing from last fall's council staff retreat. This discussion will be led by our facilitator, Aaron Lacombe, and it will be, I think, an opportunity for the council and staff to get together and to kind of work through some of the challenges that our communities are facing. Elected officials, they face a relentless demand from the politics of the area. They have their constituents in their ear, pressure from advocacy groups, and they're constantly pulled towards, you know, short-term wins, whereas like staff and the county managers, on the other hand, sort of live in the reality of operations. You know, we have to work within the legal frameworks, financial constraints, and legislative constraints. And so I think this is a good opportunity for us to kind of ferret out where we need to go going forward.
Sure. Now, did anything happen in the legislative session that could change any housing plans here in Summit County?
Well, there were tweaks that were made to a number of housing bills, and we haven't really had an opportunity as staff to sit down and digest each one of those changes yet. But that is something that we'll definitely be doing, because if we alter our moderate income housing plan, we'll have to do so, start that process through the planning commissions in probably May.
All right. It sounds like you'll be providing data showing that we have a 1,600 plus unit deficiency in housing. The majority of that is for those earning less than 30% of the AMI. So put some numbers on that for us. What is Summit County's current AMI, and how much would 30% of that be?
Okay, well, the 30% AMI, of course, is very challenging. Both from a renter standpoint and from a for sale standpoint. If I were to pull that up, let me see what I've got here. One second. Let's see if I can find that data for you. I know that like on a studio apartment, a 30% AMI would rent in the $800 range. And I just calced out all these numbers for someone else. So let me look at it. Here we go. So for a studio apartment, if somebody were to purchase that unit, that would need to cost around $64,000. At 50%, that would have to be $142,000. At 60%, $180,000. At 80%, $258,000. And at the 100% AMI level, it would have to be $338,000. And at 120% AMI, it would be about $417,000. So it's extremely challenging if you were to search for a studio condo in our region by those price points. How many do you think you would find?
I'm guessing none, but yeah.
Yeah, I think you would be correct. And so that's where the challenge lies. So a lot of times housing policy kind of, as part of your strategy, you'll say, okay, for ownership units, we'll not target going below 60% AMI. And then for those that are below 60% AMI, then we'll target the majority of our efforts towards rentals for that population.
Now, one of the slides in the packet brings up the often quoted policy 2.3 of the Snyderville Basin Development Code that no new entitlements may be approved unless there's a compelling reason to do so. There it says a myth. So is the county, is it a myth, or is the county making decisions like this policy is a myth?
Well, I didn't prepare that slide.
Okay.
All I can tell you is that there are also other policies in advance of that, where instead of 2.3, if you read 2.1 and 2.2, then it also says identify, plan, and create neighborhood master plans, specific plans where development, redevelopment should occur. These designated areas should be rezoned accordingly. So there's an action within the comprehensive plan that says they should be rezoned. And policy 2.2 says identify specific areas where development should not occur and zone it accordingly. And then policy 2.3, do not approve any new entitlements beyond those permitted by development code unless. And so I guess the issue of, you know, what exactly meets that threshold is something that we could also talk about during this meeting.
So the questions being posed to the council are what type of housing, where should it go, and how much should be built? My guess is that's not going to get decided in the work session, but how do you move forward?
Well, I think the first thing is to simply have the discussion, understand, you know, the changing demographics of our area, the changing demands with regards to, you know, our long-range employment growth shows that, you know, we'll add over the next 10 years approximately 6,600 jobs. But at our demographic model is also showing that for that same period of time, that we'll lose approximately 256 in population. So there's a huge, you know, issue there from the standpoint that if you were to survey most people about the impacts of growth, they're really talking about cars and automobile traffic. And so if you're going to import 6,600 workers, then that may prove challenging on top of what we're already importing.
Yeah, very interesting, though. So it's job growth that is creating the housing need. Or, like you say, we could import them, but we're going to pay for it with traffic.
That is correct. And that may have impacts on our air quality. That also doesn't, you know, address your declining school enrollments. Also, the wage inflation that, you know, if you're importing workers, you have to make it worth their while to make that drive.
Right.
And so, you know, what does that do to small business when it comes to being able to be competitive in the marketplace?
So what are you hoping to get out of the discussion?
I would really like the council and staff to come to some agreement with regards to a predictable sort of ongoing process. You know, every time the moderate income housing plan report rolls around, there's a bit of panic and trying to put information together for that. And, you know, crossing our fingers that we pass our review so that we can, you know, have access to our transportation funds. And I think that what I would like to see is just, you know, an agreed upon path to where we're all pulling on the same oar.
Yeah.
That's what I would like to see.
The Housing Authority, is that operating at this point?
The Housing Authority has been created. We're still, you know, have some next steps. You know, we're in the process of registering the authority with the state of Utah. We have to adopt bylaws, appoint commissioners, and we're interviewing some candidates coming up here in the next week or so that would also staff that authority. And then, you know, we need to put together an interlocal agreement between the authority and the county. And then some of the things that I would like to see put together would be an operation procedures manual, like what are the kinds of projects that the authority would like to embark upon for the next year. We also have a number of action items like complete a utility study, get a housing dashboard put together that would be available online for people, examine employer-assisted housing programs, and then, you know, administer an Eastern Summit County housing incentive program for qualifying projects.
Okay, Jeff, anything else you want to mention?
No, just everybody tune in and and look forward to a discussion on Wednesday.
All right. Jeff Jones is Summit County Housing and Economic Development Director. Thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
And also in the studio with me, Jana Young, the Deputy County Manager. Thanks for being here, Jana.
Thanks for having me.
So on Friday, the Summit County Council will be meeting with the Park City Council in a joint meeting starting at 8:30 at the Richens Auditorium. First up, a discussion on the current recycling efforts. We've heard from Recycle Utah, which says, hey, we'll chip in, but waste management is inherently a city or county function. So have we made any progress on moving Recycle Utah or building a new collection transfer station?
Yeah, thanks for bringing up this issue. As you know, the city council and the county council meet on a frequent basis to talk about issues of mutual concern and interest. And our solid waste and recycling is definitely one of those. I appreciate that you mentioned the Recycle Utah presentations they did recently on a study they commissioned from a third-party consultant that indicated Summit County's diversion rate was only 12%, which is lower than the national average in other mountain resort communities. When we talk about diversion rate, we're meaning the amount of waste that's created in our community but is sent to other places than our landfill. That study also recommended two plans for increasing diversion in the county to extend the lifespan of the county's landfill. So we attended these presentations. I think the Summit County and Park City Councils are interested now in getting a briefing from the county solid waste manager to better understand where the county currently is so we can engage in a discussion about our next steps as a community. I think there is a discrepancy perhaps in that diversion rate. It's still low. I think we agree with that. But the numbers presented by Recycle Utah didn't include the commercial sector. So that's one of the things that our county, our solid waste manager will talk about. He also, I don't know if you remember, because this was a number of years ago, but back in 2018, the county council at that time adopted a new solid waste master plan that proposed different options for extending the lifespan of the landfill along with possible funding sources. Since that time, we've been working internally and externally with partners on various diversion programs in alignment with that plan. For example, they're collecting mattresses at the landfill, electronic waste. We're doing things around cardboard and green waste. So we want the councils to hear from our landfill superintendent about those efforts and discuss where we want to go next.
So Recycle Utah is recommending a $25 million project. So where does money like that come from? I mean, are we talking now about higher tipping fees? Because we know that county residents are already paying an additional garbage fee on top of the property taxes. I think it's like up to about $80.
That's correct. That's always a challenge, funding for these programs. Currently, we have an enterprise fund for the landfill, and our collections is primarily covered by that fee. We're able to do what we can do now, but certainly if we're going to expand those efforts, it will cost more. And I do think that's part of the discussion and where we want to go with that. We do have pretty low tipping fees, so that's a consideration. We also know that we have a few other revenue sources now from the emergency services sales tax that voters approved last November, as well as the legislature just passed some flexibility within the TRT. So obviously there has to be a nexus to tourism to use both of those revenue sources, but it is an opportunity for us to consider some of these things.
Okay, so what's next here? We're gonna settle on a location or just the agreement that we're moving Recycle Utah and creating some kind of transfer station?
Yeah, the county has offered up some land to Recycle Utah. We'll discuss that on Friday with both city council or both councils. Those conversations are ongoing. And so, again, that's why we want to talk about it on Friday.
All right. A regional park and ride study follow-up discussion. This was a study done by Park City and Summit County showing that most park and ride lots still have capacity, the busiest ones, of course, in the best, the ideal locations in Old Town Park City. We see like an 86% occupancy at the highest, and at the Kimball Junction Library, there are only 36 spaces, but up to like a 94% use of that. So what does that mean, that we need to put more parking in those two locations or near those locations?
Let me give a little bit of context to this issue. So in another display of partnership between the county and Park City, our respective staffs did a joint regional park and ride study. It was funded by a Utah Department of Transportation grant with the goal of developing a regional supported park and ride plan and strategy. These facilities can be quite effective, particularly during peak season, to mitigate traffic congestion. However, we really need to approach this in a collaborative way between our two jurisdictions to really move the needle. So this study didn't specifically look at locations for park and rides, and I don't think that'll be necessarily discussed on Friday, but rather, as you mentioned, studied the capacity of our current facilities and recommended approaches for a joint strategy going forward. Also including other partners like UDOT and High Valley Transit. And then there was also a robust public outreach component. So I think Friday's discussion with the two councils will be about the findings of this study and next steps. I think some of the key takeaways from the study is that most existing park and ride lots have capacity, but Kimball Junction is frequently at capacity, and now Richardson Flat is seeing dramatic increases. And so many of these existing facilities could actually benefit from additional capacity and also amenities to encourage folks to park there and ride public transit, particularly at our gateway corridors of State Route 224 and 248, where we can really capture those trips. But if we are to either expand or build more of these facilities, you know, that will be a cost. And in order to expand capacity, that likely we will need to build more or larger park and rides.
Yeah, and I guess if we were to build more, I mean, is that the idea rather than letting the cars come into town like Kimball Junction? I mean, that just creates more traffic and cluster. I mean, is it better just to keep them outside of these busy areas?
Yeah, it's definitely a policy decision, and we'll have to see what the councils want to do with that. I think there is a strong argument to be made that let's try to capture the cars before they come into the community. Even in some of the discussions I've been part of, we've talked about even what can we do in Salt Lake, what can we do in Heber City, you know, these places before people even get up into our community, let alone into the Kimball Junction area or along State Route 248. So I definitely think that will be part of the discussion.
Okay. And finally, there'll be a discussion on a state retail liquor store. Any idea where this is planned for?
Yeah, let me start by saying I'm not an expert on this issue. I'm learning more about it just as the rest of the two councils. But what I understand from our planning director, Peter Barnes, is the state reached out to us because they are interested in locating and operating a retail liquor store at the northwest corner of Old Highway 40 and State Route 248. Now, state code exempts state-owned land from county and city jurisdiction, meaning our building and zoning codes don't apply in this case. However, the state is required to share their plans with us and allow us the opportunity to comment. This particular project or proposed project is somewhat complicated because it crosses jurisdictional boundaries between the county and the city. And so I think Friday's discussion is really just to present this issue, let folks know about it, explore what, if anything, we're responsible for if this were to be built and how we might benefit from it, and really how to respond to a project that is crossing our two jurisdictions.
So can we kind of narrow down the location? Are we talking like maybe out by that new Maverick station? Is that where?
I'm not exactly sure. All I have is it's the northwest corner of Old Highway 40 and State Route 248. But okay. I imagine it's probably related to that. It seems there's not a lot of options out there. So,
Okay, Jan, anything else you wanted to mention?
Well, hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about the legislative session at some point. I do want the community to know, if we have time, that kind of a big last minute thing happened on the last day, which is by far the biggest disappointment this session. This is HB 356, which we've talked about before, which is the county government amendments. This bill targets Summit County's form of government, and it would require us to change from electing our county council members at large, as is the current structure, to electing all five members from districts. What's disappointing is we have been told this bill was dead. And it was revived late in the night on the very last day of the session and passed both bodies as one of the last votes taken before the clock ran out. From the moment we found out about this bill, we had concerns that the state, particularly a legislator from South Jordan who does not represent us, would interfere in how we organize ourselves locally. You know, there's really nothing more democratic than deciding at the local level how and who should represent you in your local government. And our contention was and always has been that this should be a decision made by the county voters, which they did do in 2006. Instead, this whole situation was very cloak and dagger with no transparency. We were never told who was behind the effort or their connection to the bill sponsor. We now know that the Summit County Republicans were behind the bill and working with our legislators behind our backs, even though our legislators purported to be helping us. We were wondering, why hide it from us? You know, we could have had a conversation about it, studied it with our community, engaged other voters, and possibly come up with a collaborative bill together. And I think regardless of your preference or personal philosophy on this issue, it feels wrong that a small group of voters with connections to the legislature have the power to decide this issue for the entire community. The whole enterprise around this bill is a shameful political stunt with no integrity to community involvement or transparency, particularly since the bill was pulled from committee consideration in the Senate, denying us the opportunity to go on the record with our concerns. You know, we often brush off late night surprises on the last day of the legislative session as, well, that's just politics or that's how things are done in the legislature, but it's not right, it's not ethical, it's not transparent government, and we should expect and demand better from our elected representatives.
So is there any way to make things different?
We're going to try. You know, we'll continue looking at this issue and see if we can do something during a special session, but even the way it decides the districts doesn't work for our community. It puts a lot of pressure on our mayors who aren't experts in that. It doesn't have adequate representation from unincorporated county voices. Additionally, the bill allows our current members to finish out their terms, which is appropriate because voters voted for those folks. But it requires the clerk to decide which districts they represent by a lottery. So for instance, Candace Hart, who lives in Pinebrook, could be assigned North Summit District, and Tanya, who lives in Colville, could be assigned the Pinebrook District, and then essentially would not allow Candace to run for re-election because his term ends before Tanya's, and so ostensibly his seat would be occupied. So it really doesn't make any sense. It needs a lot of fixes in addition to just the fact that we weren't included in the conversation.
Okay, I'll follow up. Jana, thanks.
Thank you.
That's Deputy Summit County Manager Jana Young. 2025 Utah Legislature, a wrap. On the phone with a recap of what happened in just the short 45 days, I have KUER reporter Sage Miller. Good morning, Sage.
Good morning, Leslie.
So most importantly, we've got a $30 billion budget approved. How did taxpayers fare in this?
Oh, yeah. So for the fifth year in a row, lawmakers approved another income tax cut. It's not very big. It goes from 4.55% down to 4.50%. So the average family will save anywhere, if you're the top high 1% earner, you're going to be saving about $2,000. If you're the low 20% of the income bracket, you're saving about $13 a year. So really a lot of variation there. But I will say we were in a budget deficit this year. Our revenue forecasts are down roughly about $112 million, according to a February estimate. So even then, they have set aside $50 million for a salary increase for teachers of about $1,500, plus $50 million for $1,000 bonuses for educator support staff, as well as about $8 million for Governor Cox Operation Gigawatt, which is to bolster energy production here in the state and to specifically look at nuclear power in the state. And we also got $20 million for the first-time homebuyer program. I will say with this budget deficit, though, a lot of programs, specifically social programs, got little to no funding. So specifically when it's looking at domestic violence support programs and sexual assault support programs, they saw little to no funding. And that really has them worried that a lot of these programs that help survivors overcome these hardships are going to shutter. So we are seeing kind of a give and take here with them. And then also on the governor's big push to eliminate the income tax on Social Security benefits, didn't can't make it through the finish line. So they did increase and expand a tax credit for seniors in the state if they make up to $90,000. Other than that, the governor did not get his wish on the budget on a lot of things besides mostly Operation Gigawatt to expand energy production here.
As you mentioned, teachers did get a pay raise. How did that impact then the weighted pupil unit? I mean, did lawmakers basically use Peter, the WPU, to pay Paul, the teachers?
So what they did was increase WPU by 4%, which is the minimum amount a state law requires legislators to raise to keep up with inflation. That's a good question about exactly where this 1,000 pay raise came from. Lawmakers are very much so championing this thing. Now we are now in the top five states with the highest starting salary for teachers. That's probably coming out of the general fund with that. And that's specifically kind of in response to the public sector union bill that bans public sectors from collectively bargaining. The largest teachers union in the state came out very hard against this and arguing that is the reason why they're able to get raises is because of collective bargaining and going to the legislature and making the case for why teachers should make more money. This was essentially a way to say, no, lawmakers are your boss. We are the ones that decide how long your paycheck is. And here you go. Here's an extra a funding mechanism to increase your teacher wages. So that's where a lot of that money came from. This announcement of teachers getting a $1,000 raise came after the governor signed that ban on public sector collective bargaining. So it kind of seems like some politics are happening there. The UEA, who is the largest teachers union, put out a scathing statement about the raises, saying this was a political move. And I should mention that the largest teachers union has filed a referendum on the law. They filed that on Saturday, right after the legislature ended, and they have to collect about 140,000 signatures across the 29 counties in Utah in order to even land the referendum on the ballot. So they have a very large uphill battle in front of them if they want to try and overturn this law whatsoever. But they said it very much so is targeted at them. And that it hurts teachers instead of helps them.
All right. Another House Bill 265 also passed. This is the bill that requires state universities to reallocate funding to programs that are high demand to eliminate others. So what is this going to do?
Yeah, so I think a lot of universities are now going to the drawing board to try and figure out what this looks like. So lawmakers are withholding about $60 million from Utah's 8-degree granting public colleges. So that's USU, the University of Utah, Weber State. And it essentially sets up, you know, a framework for them to earn this money back through these reinvestment plans. But the schools have to show that how they plan to cut certain insufficient programs. I'm putting insufficient in quotes because I don't think there's necessarily a definition for that. That's something that universities are going to have to figure out. And then from those insufficient programs, they need to redirect that saved money towards, quote, high demand parts of their curriculum. That's really up for interpretation. So there's some lawmakers who say, you know, like modern dance, for example, that has perhaps a low turnout of graduates. Maybe we should spend less money there and reinvest that into chemical engineering, where we see a high demand and a lot of people churning out a lot of people who are graduating from those degrees. So there is still some speculation about what this actually means and how universities are going to reinvest and reallocate this money. But it essentially, if it doesn't satisfy state leaders, they're not going to get this money back. And lawmakers argued this is a sure way to make sure that taxpayers are having their money spent as efficiently as possible in order to increase the amount of graduates and people entering Utah's workforce. This has been hotly contested on both the Democrat and the Republican side. There's been a handful of Republicans that have come out and said, I don't specifically believe that the way that we are propping up this reinvestment plan is going to be good. We're only looking at certain ways to identify what success is. And it's that's them graduating and then them entering the job market. But what if they're trying to start their own business? What if they're trying to innovate? What if they're going back and teaching the next generation? They say that these things weren't necessarily taken into consideration during the build of HB 265. So we'll see. what exactly happens, but it's definitely put your head to the table, put your marker on the drawing board, and figure out what you're going to do.
All right. And despite public pushback, lawmakers approved Senate Bill 277, which disbands the State Records Committee for an administrative judge. So how do you think this impacts the work that you and other journalists do?
That is, I will say that this is going to impact the everyday Utah citizen significantly more than it's going to impact journalists like me and my reporting partner, Sean Higgins. On average, Utahns use public records requests more than journalists do. And what essentially this does is that we had a state records committee that if I was denied a public record from, I don't know, a public water utility company or from the governor's office, and I believe that that was a wrong denial, I could go in front of this 7-person committee that was all volunteered. They were appointed by the governor and they were approved by the Senate, but they were all volunteers, and I would make my case to them saying, hey, I believe that I should have access to this record because it's of the public interest, and there's no reason in law or code that states I should not have access to this. They would make their ruling, and then I would either win or I would lose. Now what this does, it gets rid of the 7 record committee and does, like you said, it appoints a judge that was appointed by the governor and approved by the Senate. Mike McKell, who is the sponsor of this bill, he's a Republican from Utah County, says that the 7 record committee is too slow and it's too inefficient, and we've seen a increase in appeals in recent years, specifically after COVID, which I would say, again, a lot of the people who are appealing records because of COVID were just everyday Utah citizens. It wasn't necessarily journalists. And he says, yeah, it's too slow. A judge will make this go faster who has better knowledge about the public record system, and that a 7-person records committee was even hard to align schedules because people have lives to live. And so finding a day in the month where they all worked was difficult. I will say we're not totally sure how this will impact us as journalists. I do know that the Utah Media Coalition, after a lot of revisions on this bill, has come out neutral on it. So they've taken no position. It's just going to probably be more of a learning curve. But Mike McKell says this is definitely going to be championed in a few years when he argues people get through the process a lot faster with appeals. So it did eke out with enough votes, but it didn't have an overwhelming amount of support. And that's what some lawmakers say is because of the overwhelming opposition from members of the public. But either way, it passed, and now we just await for the governor's appointment.
Okay, real quick, want to get through a couple more here. Where did the vote-by-mail bills end up, including House Bill 300, which I believe passed?
Yes, elections, that is the one that makes big changes to Utah's vote-by-mail system and probably the biggest election bill that came out of the session. That did pass with significant changes, and they have a very long runway. It won't go into effect until 2029, so they have a lot of runway to try and work out the kinks here. But essentially, the too long didn't read version is, starting in 2029, all voters in the state of Utah are going to have to opt in to receive their vote by mail, to receive their ballot by mail, and to return their ballot by mail. If they do not opt in, they will have to vote in person. Additionally, they're going to have to put the last 4 digits of a valid ID on their ballot as a voter ID measure. Up until 2029, voters are going to have to put their signature and the last 4 digits in order to help clerks identify. But after that, after 2029, it'll just be your ID. And that is causing some grave concerns on both sides of the aisle. They say it's probably going to make it less secure in a lot of ways if you just need the last 4 digits of your ID number instead of just your signature, or instead of just both, because it's a lot easier to memorize the last 4 digits of your husband's ID number than it is to forge his signature, for example. So they have until 2029 before this goes into full effect. I've gotten word from both the House and the Senate that idea of signatures and the ID number is something that's going to be kinked out within the next few years, working with clerks and during the interim session. But changes to vote by mail are definitely on the way.
Okay. And any action on the immigration bills that we saw?
Yes. So the biggest immigration bill that I think that you're referring to is HB 226, which decreases, it increases the maximum sentence for Class A misdemeanors from 364 days to 365 days. So a whole day. But per federal law, if an immigrant spends 1 year in jail or prison, it automatically initiates the deportation process. So this is a way for them to speed up the deportation process for individuals who may be here illegally, who have entered the criminal justice system. This has been also hotly contested, mostly because there's arguments that this law is actually going to wrap up legal immigrants who are here. So they did decrease the amount of Class A misdemeanors that were eligible for this to what they consider very severe crimes. So this is either like sexual assault, stalking, child abuse, or violation of a protective order. And I will say that driving under the influence is also included in this list of crimes. But there's been some concern, for example, from both Republicans and from Democrats that worry that this disproportionately targets legal immigrants. For example, let's say there is a protective order out and somebody runs into their ex or the person that took out a protective order on them on the grocery store. They could get wrapped up in this proceedings, get sentenced to a year in jail, despite them being here legally, are sent to their home country. So again, there's a lot of kinks that need to be worked out on this, but as of right now, that is how it stands. It just makes it easier to deport people here, either here with legal status or here without legal status.
Okay, and finally wanted to ask you about the Olympics bill, that what it was being called, Senate Bill 333, which would provide some tax revenue for infrastructure and transportation.
Yes, this one is a little bit wonky, so bear with me. What this would essentially do is allow cities to collect 75% of property taxes and up to 100% of sales tax and use taxes to pay for these improvements in these arena zones. And so that's like the places in Park City, like the what's it called, Leslie? Now it's like spacing my, it's like right by
Utah,
the outlets. Yes. Yeah. Gives allows them in that zone specifically to make improvements to either the spectator areas or the roads leading up to it, maybe the parking lots, maybe improvements to the venues themselves. But this is only applicable to Olympic arenas and Olympic venues. So it wouldn't impact baseball or the basketball stadium here down in Salt Lake City at the Delta Center or the potential new baseball stadium out in Fair Park. It would just be related to the Olympic Games. Some argue that these like improvements are needed, especially as the Olympics is slated to come back in about 10 years. And they're going to have to move fast, right? Because construction takes a long time and the Olympics will be here before we know it. But there are some arguments that this kind of tax is not going to be great. It's going to take away money from schools, for example, because you're using property taxes in that zone, mostly for these venues and not for other facets. So it did pass, and people are going to have to apply. So cities are going to have to apply to the Department of Government Opportunity to get their zones approved and to get any of that money. Again, it's not any state money. It will all just be local funds coming that need to be approved by the state, though.
Okay. I've got to leave it there, Sage. Appreciate all of the call-ins, as well as with your colleague, Sean Higgins. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
Well, the People's Health Clinic in the process of creating a patient advisory committee. In the studio with details, I have the director of operations for People's Health Clinic, Dahlia Gonzalez. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so what does a patient advisory committee do?
Yes, thank you for asking that. So our patient advisory council that we're starting to build up with our patients will help share our mission and care at the People's Health Clinic. We would like to hear our patients' perspective and also learn from them for us to be able to make a better impact for their health.
So is this something that they meet regularly, monthly?
So our patients can expect to have regular meetings and can expect to also receive compensation for their time. These regular meetings can be virtual and in person. We want to make sure that we're inclusive to our entire patient population. And we are inviting our patients actually today for them to submit a submission of their interest. We will be reviewing those submission forms and determine how many people we want to be part of that committee.
So to be on the committee, you have had to have been a patient at People's Health Clinic.
Correct, yes.
Okay, how many people do you think you'll name?
You know, we are trying to determine that. We have a group of staff and board members that are part of this committee forming so that we can determine whether we want at least 10 or 15 representatives of that patient advisory committee.
Okay, and then you say they're getting paid. Like how much?
Yeah, so that is something that is still to be determined. We will be providing them compensation via gift cards that they can use either for groceries, gas, anything that they would like to use that for.
Okay, and when do you hope to have that running?
Yeah, so after today, we are asking them to submit their submissions by next Tuesday, and we will be reviewing those submissions and getting in touch with them early April so that we can start forming this group, have them also set up their expectations between their group and how often they want to meet. And the goal is that this patient advisory council can provide their input to our board members. Our board is super crucial for People's Health Clinic, but we also want to hear from our patient population.
Great. All right. Clinic is also trying to reduce its environmental impact. I mean, when we think of medical waste, we know it's pretty incredible. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, exactly, Leslie. So we at the People's Health Clinic do have waste, and we're trying to improve our waste disposal and also our recycling. We're very thankful that pharmaceutical manufacturers do provide us with free medications, but the way that those medications arrive are in cardboard and styrofoam is not the best way of packaging, and so we're trying to identify ways of being able to reuse that or ask those manufacturers to take back that styrofoam. Currently, thanks to Recycle Utah, we are able to dispose of that recycling locally, and they take care of it. We did reach out recently to Nuzzles & Co. to see if they would be willing to take the styrofoam containers, because we learned, thanks to our partners at Intermountain Health, that usually some of these animal shelters will take these styrofoam containers to be able to use those for housing for the cats.
Okay, but they only need so many.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so does the waste that you are trying to deal with, I mean, does it require any special treatment? Certainly cardboard doesn't. Styrofoam, again, would take some special treatment.
And it's,
but are we talking just other stuff that would go to the landfill, or are we talking stuff that needs to go to an incinerator?
Yeah, incinerator as well. So we're thinking about our biohazard. We're thinking about the medications that expire. And we're also thinking about our sharps containers, all of our needles. So that is where we are going to focus on this year. And thanks to Intermountain Healthcare, our partners, we've had an initial meeting to see how we can piggyback from them. We are an affiliate clinic for Intermountain Healthcare. We have close proximity to Park City Hospital, and we're trying to see how we can jump on their wagon to be able to dispose of our waste and our recycling.
Okay. Let's see. The clinic also committed to ensuring that patients receive healthcare without barriers to access. So what are you hearing from your patients?
Yeah, so we want to make sure that our patients know that our doors have remained open since 2025, the beginning of the year. There was a lot of conversation whether or not our nonprofit was going to have the door still open, especially knowing that we were going to have a new administration to the nation. And we wanted to make sure that our patients know, and we reached out to them after also we were hearing that our patients were asking us if there were ever encounters that they might be concerned about when arriving to the clinic, and we've let them know that we're there to keep them safe. We have put up signs in our building, our facility, the area of our facility, that mentioned that we are a private entity, and if we are there to protect them.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm guessing patients have expressed some concern about perhaps ice raids or rain?
Correct. Thank you. That was what I was alluding to a little bit. So we did have some phone calls to our clinic asking us whether ice was present at the facility or in our parking lot. And we were able to debunk that. We made an investigation to see if they were even in the area. They were not. And we did inform our patients that they could still present to the clinic. However, we recognize that for some of them, they might be still fearful. So we do offer telemedicine, and we also offer transportation assistance if they need that.
So is there a way for the clinic to determine if you have agents in the area?
Well, there isn't a way, but we could make our observations to see if they're in the lobby of our facility or in the parking lot. I'm sure that we can ask questions if we were to see people in suits or in uniform, but we also are going to be following the law. If there is a warrant and if they present that, if it's a lawful warrant, we will follow the law.
Sure. Are you seeing patient numbers drop off by people who may be afraid of being targeted?
Actually, Leslie, no, the numbers are not decreasing. The numbers are staying where they have been. And even actually, we've noticed an increase in patient population. We have noticed that our patients know that they can trust us. We are in our organization that have been in operation for 25 years, which is celebrating 25 years in December. And the numbers are still rising.
Okay. Anything else, Dahlia, you wanted to mention?
Yeah, Leslie. So I just want to make the community aware that the People's Health Clinic is for Summit and Wasatch County for the uninsured community. And our doors are open Monday through Friday. We do have extended hours on Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays for those that might like an evening appointment. And everybody is welcome to call People's Health Clinic for an appointment. Our phone number is 435-333-1850. And if they would like to submit any questions before maybe getting on the phone call, everybody is welcome to submit an inquiry via our website, peopleshealthclinic.org.
Okay. Dahlia, thanks so much.
Thank you, Leslie.
Dahlia Gonzalez, again, is the Director of Operations for People's Health Clinic.